BCFM 93.2.
The mysteries originated in the Middle East and have spread across the world. And so they take a large percentage of the mysticism and the religion and the magic and the occult knowledge of the people of the Middle East. Most Freemasons do not even understand that when they circumambulate the lodge with the master sitting in the east representing the rising sun, that they are practicing an ages-old pagan rite to their true deity. Albert Pike himself revealed the true God of Freemasonry. And he and many others have made the clear statement that Freemasonry is indeed a religion.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Could the VI paedophile cover-up go right to the top of the Metropolitan Police? Testimony tonight from an ex-Scotland Yard detective. Also, Jens Stoltenberg has been in the UK this week, and Prime Minister Theresa May has been increasing Britain's commitment to his NATO alliance. Nevertheless, he says it could all break up. We look also at one powerful arm of the Israel lobby tonight, which began around the same time as the Zionist project back in the late 1800s, the B'nai B'rith. What do these Hebrew words mean? And what are they, and what is their real agenda? What's the B'nai B'rith's links to Las Vegas gangster Meyer Lansky and the Party of Organised Crime in the United States? Why was their Anti-Defamation League committee silent all during Hitler's persecution of the Jews? Who better to answer that than the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany's lawyer Jacob Chaitkin's son, author of the unauthorised biography of George Bush Sr., Anton Chaitkin? Also, bringing the look at the Israel lobby bang up to date, time to ask Israeli saxophonist, now based in the UK, Gilad Atzmon, why he believes the origin of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party and elsewhere is a vicious circle. And how far-right Zionist leaders like Netanyahu perversely benefit from anti-Semitism. Finally, he looks at why pro-Palestinian musicians such as Pink Floyd's Roger Waters are considered such a threat by the Israel lobby. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, We Are Change Rotterdam stopped by to tell us about their work in Turin, Italy, reporting on the Conference of the Secret Rulers of the Western World, the Bilderberg Conference. Plus, we travel to Peru with Bristolian Chris Woods, who decided to follow up in the footsteps of Sting, Tori Amos, David Icke and others to try out the hallucinogenic drug ayahuasca. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. I'll download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, we've got this Donald Trump visit. This is going to kind of concentrate people's minds next month, isn't it, on all these issues going on around the world. And we hear again, literally today, a report that a US airstrike has killed 8 in eastern Syria. I mean, it does seem as if the Americans are there to stay in Syria.
Yeah, despite Donald Trump saying that they were going to leave. So that shows you who really determines the policy in the United States, and it ain't Donald Trump.
In the background to all of this, of course, we've got the trade war going on. Yeah. Trump is threatening EU with 20% tariffs on all cars. The trade war does seem to be escalating. It's like a ratchet. Yeah. Yeah. As one side puts another tariff on, so the EU and the United States... the trouble here, of course, is that there are enormous corporations that are... transnational. They're based both in the EU and in the United States.
Yeah, and if you see what's happening in the stock markets, they're starting to wobble. And if there's a full-on trade war, they'll crash. And that's what will happen. And then people say, well, where'd all the money go? And it'll just have disappeared down the drain. And that's where we're at. I'm afraid it's most likely outcome, by far.
Well, what's your prognosis for Syria? Because we've got the Russians absolutely not, they're not going anywhere. They're definitely staying there. But the Americans, it doesn't seem as if they want to leave either. We've also got fractures going on within the NATO alliance. It was announced this week that the new F-35, although it's a little bit of a dodgy aeroplane, the most high-tech aircraft being produced by the US for NATO, Turkey is now not allowed to buy it. They wanted to buy some, I imagine, to let the Russians have a look at one, but they've been told by the Congress now you're not allowed to have these things.
Well, that's because they decided to buy the SS-400s from Russia. So, I mean, the world is in flux, and Syria, of course, is the cauldron in which these geopolitical battles are being fought, much to the unfortunate luck of the poor old Syrian people who've been put through the mincer by all of this politicking.
Can you just give us a short version of why Syria has been right at the apex of this over the last nearly 10 years now, and why it looks as if it's going to continue to be at the apex in the future?
Well, General Wesley Clark, the former head of NATO Europe, I think he was, he said, well, I was told by senior people in the Pentagon that we were going to attack, you know, 7 countries in 5 years, and Syria was on the list. And of course,
Iran was on the list.
Yes,
well.
Iran is still on the list.
Lebanon was on the list.
Lebanon isn't directly on the list, but the implication is that that's going to be dragged into the war in Syria. And what happened was they thought that the Assad regime in Syria was going to collapse in the same way as the Gaddafi regime in Libya.
So, as America's
and of course,
planned
it didn't.
To take over the Middle East ground to a halt now.
Yeah, because the battles around Damascus are like the Stalingrad of World War III, and the Americans have been beaten. They're not accepting being beaten. All they can do now is sabotage the peace, but they're going to do that. They're determined to do
so that. So Jens Stoltenberg's been in the Secretary General of NATO in London this week. Let's hear from him and Theresa May.
Thank you so much, Prime Minister Theresa. Thank you for welcoming me here today, and thank you for your personal commitment to our alliance. The United Kingdom has long led by example in NATO, and you continue to do so. You lead the NATO battle group in Estonia. Royal Air Force jets patrol the skies over the Black Sea.
Today, the Secretary General and I welcome the progress made on modernising NATO while recognising that there is more to do. There's been much discussion about the need for allies to take on greater responsibility by increasing their spending on defence, and we welcome the steps that NATO allies have taken since the Wales summit 4 years ago. Burden sharing will be one of the key items on the agenda for the summit in July, where we will take stock of progress since the leaders' meeting last May and the Warsaw and Wales summits.
But Theresa May talks also there, Martin, about one of the things she says is that there's an increasing commitment to more and more military officers in Britain taking on NATO roles.
Well, I mean, we're having our arms twisted up our back by the Americans to spend 2% of GDP on military, and basically buying the stuff from the Americans. That's what we'll be buying the F-35, and that means that we're closing hospitals and schools and closing libraries and toilets, but we're going to spend money on the F-35, and that's what that's all about. And of course, why is the British Army in Estonia, for example? We promised Gorbachev years ago that if he allowed freedom in Eastern Europe and let the Berlin Wall come down, that NATO wouldn't expand one inch towards Russia. And now, of course, right on Russia's border. What would we do if the Russians were having very serious exercises in France about invading the south of England? How would we feel about that? And, of course, the Russian army on the other side of the border from Estonia are watching, you know, with some alarm, these exercises. And, of course, the potential for conflict is quite big in the Baltic states. You've got a very large Russian minority, particularly in Latvia and less so in Lithuania. So the potential for conflict is definitely there. And we're going around kicking sandcastles over. And eventually, do you know what? We might get the fight we claim we don't want. And then what would we do?
BCFM. Well, we're going to come back home now and to the UK and revisit, as we do quite regularly on this programme, the VI paedophile scandal. That is really the government's complete failure to have any kind of proper inquiry into the very serious allegations of VI paedophilia, particularly having the Home Office manage the inquiry, the national inquiry into child sexual abuse. The Home Office being, of course, the prime suspects in actually being involved in child sexual abuse themselves. And it was quite fascinating, I thought, last weekend to hear, and I'm going to share it with you now, this interview with DC Paul Wedger. He's a former Metropolitan Police detective who has looked very deeply into this. And I would suggest if you've got any children around that you turn the radio down, or the children shouldn't be listening to this, or you may wish to make sure kids can't listen. But here is what I thought was a very powerful description by him of the corruption that he saw within the Metropolitan Police about child sexual abuse. So here is now DC Paul Wedger.
I'm recently retired from the Metropolitan Police, where I served as a detective. I specialised in child abuse investigations, and what is relevant to me being here today was my service whilst on the specialist vice unit. I had been asked to look into an allegation made by a 14-year-old girl that she is being used as a prostitute. On looking into it, it appeared that this girl was one of many. She gave me another girl, who in turn gave me another, and it just spiralled. Very, very quickly, we had dozens of young kids aging from 9 to 14 years old. All of them were subject to care orders, either looked after or, in placements, homes or whatever, but all known to the social services. A lot of them were known to the police for being missing persons and everything else. And all of them were addicted to crack cocaine and heroin and were all being pimped out, as the term goes, by one person, which was a female prostitute who was very well known to the Met Police. And this woman had alleged connections with high-ranked officers and also a local magistrate. And someone that was high up here, executive status in the BBC. This woman seemed to work with impunity for many, many years, and when looking into it, this actual racket had been going on for a long, long time. What I did was I exposed my findings, I committed them to paper in what was just a basic intelligence report, and I took it to a senior officer. And what I must say, that this isn't the first time that I'd been shut down for exposing child abuse offences. A couple of years prior to that, if I may jump the timeline, I was on an inquiry looking into transient paedophiles that had failed to register, and I found out that they were residing on canal boats within the inland waterway network of the UK. They had information from within the prison service that there were two paedophiles that were living on boats. There was freedom to travel. The canal network was very, very old and therefore didn't get policed. And children like boats. And the BBC had a programme at the time. It was to do with two little dolls that lived on a canal boat called Rosie and Jim. And it was tied in at the same time as I was looking into this. So kids were drawn to the waterways. The reason for telling this bit was that I was told that there were two sex offenders. I was asked to look into it as a field intelligence officer, and if I found another two within a set period of time, they'd be happy. Within that period of time, I'd found 90. I came into work, and I was told by a high-ranked officer that the inquiry had been shut down, and the reason given was that they couldn't afford the funding for me. But I had been approached by a Scotland Yard detective who told me, he said, when you investigate any crime and you do well at it, you get praised. When you look into child abuse cases, the opposite happens. Be very careful. He then told me about a cabinet minister that they'd investigated on a few occasions, and on each occasion they'd been shut down. So I was aware that this had gone on. When I questioned the senior officer about, the real reason, he told me, John, I'm so sorry, it's come from high up. There's nothing I can do. And promised me any job I wanted. So I moved on to the vice unit. So I was expecting to be praised for what I found out. Each day a new child would be found, and it was just spiralling. I was brought before someone who is now a very, very high-ranked officer in the UK indeed. And he sat me down and he said, John, I've got to be very upfront with you. And I said, well, I'd like to be upfront with you, Governor, as well. And he said, you know, you're out of all the officers I've got here, there was about, I don't know, 40 officers. He said, you're the second best one I've got, which was a good accolade. He said, but unfortunately, you've dug too deep. What the hell have you done? Now, on a personal level, since the beginning of 2000, I'd brought up 4 children on my own, and this was common knowledge within my unit. And he said to me, if you ever disclose what you found out, you will lose your home, your children, and your job. You must shut the F up. And he said, you will be thrown to the wolves. You have no idea who and what you are dealing with. He said, I'm warning you now, you must back away. And then he said something quite strange, and he said that if you say a word of this, and even if you make a complaint, it will come back to me and it will go in the bin. I and no one else will ever betray fellow rank. Shut your mouth. So I walked away from that investigation and I moved on. I was offered to stay, but I couldn't. What was very strange was that the main witness, the young girl that came forward, was found dead in the street very shortly afterwards on a suspicious drug overdose, which sort of compounded matters. I then moved on to work on child abuse investigations, which is slightly different to Vice, and I can explain why there is this compartmentalisation within these institutions. And it's all down to remits, justifiable reasons for actually doing nothing as opposed to doing something. I went on to a child abuse unit in one of the poorer boroughs of London, and I was asked if I would like, as well as an investigator, take on a second role dealing with various sort of issues they have. And I was told, you'll get a day here and there to go to a meeting. And I asked to look into if there anyone was dealing with children's homes. I was told, no, there was an officer that was dealing with children's homes, but she left 2 years ago and she didn't do anything anyway because nothing happens. There's no problem. And I asked this sergeant, are there any problems with child prostitution within the kids' homes? He said, what are you on about? No, of course not. I got a list, and this is almost real time as I'm telling it now. I got a list faxed through to me from social services with all the children's homes. There was 26 kids' homes. I picked up the phone and I spoke to the fella and I asked him how many kids they have. And on an average, there's about 5 children reside in these children's homes. And I said, no, I'm not pointing the finger. No one's in any trouble. How many of these children do you lose at the weekend? Which is the usual pattern of missing, you know, when kids go missing. And so out of the 5, we lose 3. And I said, no, honestly, what happens to them? They went, oh, they're being pimped out. So this officer that had dealt with it for years had found none. Within this, honestly, this was the time, as we're speaking now, within this period of minutes, I found 3. By the end of that day, I'd found 6. By the end of 3 to 5 days, I'd found 50. I held a meeting with all the concerned agencies, which involved charities, which involved NGOs, which involved social services, and I highlighted the problem. And I was then harangued, really. I was attacked verbally by head of children's services for this borough, saying to me, what the effing hell have you done? I said, well, you knew about these kids. I said, yeah, but they hadn't come notice, so we're not worried. The children were making money, so therefore the children weren't worried. The children had a boyfriend, which was their pimp. Therefore, they thought this was love. And the children were also using drugs, so therefore they want to continue to use drugs. So they weren't coming to notice. So therefore, social services had written them off, despite the fact that the children's homes would constantly be getting in the logs that they were being picked up and they were going missing. These were regular missing persons. The police have a missing persons unit. They say so many thousands of kids go missing every year. They do, but a lot of them do return. But what is never looked into is what happens when they're going missing. They are working as prostitutes. The child abuse units won't look into them because they say it's not interfamilial, because it's someone else pimping them out. The bigger cities have vice units. Vice units will not deal with them because they say that these are kids subject to care orders. So no one looks into it, and it goes on, and it festers, and it festers. And then, funny enough, after this meeting, I was shut down and moved again. I then came forward a couple of years later. I was actually genuinely concerned that I would lose my children. I know how powerful the police are, and I know what they're capable of, having worked with them. I blew the whistle a few years ago, and I was told that my allegations would be taken at the highest level. I asked to speak to a high-ranked female detective. This was questioned, and then they did get me a high-ranked female detective, and she said to me, "Why are you talking to me and no one else?" I said, "Because you cannot roll up your trouser leg." And she said, "I understand exactly what you mean." They instigated allegations of corruption against high-ranked officers. When you investigate these crimes, as a witness and informant as I was, you're meant to get regular updates every 28 days. I never received one in 3 years. The matter was passed from one unit to another unit. It ended up with the IPCC, who again did nothing and failed to update me, despite the fact that they had corroborating evidence. I met with other police whistleblowers via a few concerned MPs. One of them was a lady called Maggie Oliver, who had exposed the scandal in Rochdale. Another one was a man called Lenny Harper, who had exposed the horrendous goings on at a kid's home called Hope de la Garenne in Jersey. Each one of them echoed each other. They both said, "They're going to come for you, and they will come hard." And I said, "What do I expect?" They said, "Right, you will be served with gross misconduct papers. You will be interviewed. They will find against you. You will be sacked, and you will probably face a court case and may go to jail." Now, the threats that was echoed to me, "You'll lose your home, your job, your children." At the same time, the police stopped paying me. I went without wages for nearly 3 years. I had four children at home. Then what happened was that they served me gross misconduct papers, and I was told, well, it'll be for data protection violations, which seems to be a common occurrence. I got served with numerous data protection violations. Each one could have given me a 2-year prison sentence. This continued and continued. Now, what also happened during this period was that one of my children was involved in a life-changing and catastrophic accident in which he was initially declared dead. They revived him. He was on life support for many, many months. I got called to attend the hospital where they had actually lost him. He'd been dead for 10 minutes. So I was called down to the hospital to basically identify him. I turned up and they had actually revived him within this period, but they deemed him as brain dead, although he was on full 100% life support. A colleague of mine was so concerned, as I had no money, and for 3 days I slept in my car and stayed by my son's side. My son actually made signs of life, and I was able to return home. But my colleague had brought this to the attention of senior officers, just saying, you know, you've got to help this man. He's actually done nothing wrong. The Met Police's response to this, when I got home, they'd sent two child protection officers round to interview my youngest boy on allegations that I left him home alone while I was with my dying son. So the threats of you will lose your home, your job and your children rang true. I persisted. I refused to give up, and I set up a forum, a working group with all the police whistleblowers, and it extended and it branched out. The IPCC stopped investigating the crime. I was meant to be given a full breakdown of what went on, and I was given a one paragraph letter and told not to contact them again. We're not investigating it. Their answer was that the three high ranked officers that I'd accused of corruption, they went and spoke to them and they denied it, and that was the extent of their investigation. And all them years as an investigator, I've been doing it wrong. You've just got to ask someone if they've done it, and if they say no, that's it. And that was what they expected me to swallow, and told me not to contact them again. I took the matter to the policing minister at the time, a member of the Privy Council and a member of the government's cabinet. He met with me, and he was actually, to my surprise, appalled. He arranged for a meeting with the Home Office. The Home Office then got their independent investigation team involved and stated that there will be an independent investigation into my claims. And they deemed that the Met Police and the IPCC had failed, and they will look into it. I was summoned to a meeting, and it was a fully recorded meeting, and it was witnessed, in which the Cabinet Minister handed my paperwork over to the Home Office officials And that was an official handover of the paperwork, which I supplied to him. They then gave me their assurances that they will be in touch with me and give me a 24-hour contact number and said they will investigate this independently. I never heard from them again. They have since denied receiving any paperwork. When pushed, they admitted they did receive it, but have now lost it. We are seeing police failings in respect to child prostitution hemorrhaging in this country, but we are seeing them on a provincial level. We're seeing them in Rochdale, Blackpool, Rotherham. We're seeing them in Oxford, Aylesbury, Swindon, all on a provincial level. London is one of the largest urban conurbations in the Western world. It has got one of the biggest police forces. We haven't heard one thing about organised child prostitution in London, and the reason being is that those high up have been covering it up, and this goes right to the heart. I was met with, as I said, Lenny Harper. Children were killed at Hôte de la Garenne, in which Lenny Harper had forensic evidence, which then went missing. And he said to me, be careful, what you're looking at will go right to the heart of the establishment. I sat down with the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick, and I explained to her what was going on. And I explained the dynamics of how you groom a child. I said, I can take a child out of a care system. I can groom that child. I can have sex with that child. I can get my friends to have sex with that child. I can pimp that child out. You have not appointed one officer to investigate that. Yet if I leant over my fence and called my neighbour a derogatory term, I'd lose my home, my job, I'd be signing on a register, and I'd never work for the Met Police again. How is that justifiable? How is it justifiable? I now work with victims and survivors of abuse. I help out with recovering alcoholics and drug addicts. I'm working in collusion now with one of the most notorious gangsters the UK had, and the convicted murderer, Chris Lambriano. And I've never had such support and compassion from these people, yet the police would have had me swinging from a rope if they've had their own way. When we look at our prison system, 75% of inmates are illiterate. This is in the UK, they're illiterate. 75% of our inmates have come from abused backgrounds. We have a recidivism rate of 75%. The system does not work. Child abuse is at the root of all of this. Child abuse units, when I was on them, I've worked on many specialist units in the police. I've worked on units that have been anti-government. I've worked on units that have been financial crime. You get given a car, you get given an expense account, you get given unlimited overtime. When I was on child abuse, we had a car between 10 of us. I worked with three alcoholics because the work was so horrendous and impactive. We had no respite. We were worked till we were dropping. And we would have appointments to see psychiatrists every 6 months, but they weren't to sign us off. They were to keep us going. Say, oh, you're all right, you're all right. Keep going, keep going. They deliberately underfund anything to do with child abuse. Deliberately, and it's done for a reason. I had many informants that came from the street. They were beggars. They were drug addicts. They had all been sexually abused as children. One of them told me of a scenario when he was in a kid's home at the age of 4, was raped on his first night by a Catholic priest. He then went on to be raped daily and whipped and beaten. He became a drug addict and he ended up as a rent boy on the street at an area of the West End where I used to work as a vice copper. And that was what was classed as the meat rack in Piccadilly Circus, where young boys were openly picked up for the purpose of prostitution. It was known about. He went to get in a car and he was in trouble. He needed drugs, so he needed the money. And he had a pimp, and he said, a pimp wasn't a bad thing. A pimp actually looked after me. I was safer with a pimp on the street than I was in a kid's home. He went to get into a car, which was a white Rolls Royce with two men in it. And his pimp said, don't go in that car. The last two boys went in there. They killed them. We never saw them again. He gesticulated for the driver to drive around the block. And his pimp didn't see this. His pimp thought he'd walked away. But he didn't. He got in the car. He was then taken to a very affluent part of London called Hampstead. He was then subjected to 3 days of torture and sexual violence, in which he said that they knew that they'd killed him. And he said they dumped his lifeless body on Hampstead Heath by the Royal Free Hospital, believing he was dead. And he said, what shocked me more, John, was the fact that these two men, they were well-dressed, they had a big house, and they were actually getting ready to go to their niece's wedding whilst they were dropping my perceived lifeless body off on a bit of heath ground. Yet it goes on consistently, consistently. Back in 2003, the justice system brought in what they called the Bad Character Act. Before, you could never bring in someone's previous convictions within a legal trial in the UK, unless it was a very, very serious one, and then it was very difficult. There were too many legal parameters. They brought this in, and everyone thought that it was a coup. It was a step forward in gaining justice. But when you commit acts, minor acts of shoplifting, it's dishonest crime. You are then deemed a dishonest person. Every person I dealt with, every street person, every crack-taking prostitute had been abused as a child. They all committed dishonest crime to stay alive. Right? They shoplifted. They pimped themselves. Whatever they did it to survive, to buy their drugs, to carry on. So whenever they were brought in a trial as a witness, they were instantly deemed as dishonest. And this is what we're seeing now when people are coming forward. They are rubbish and they're broken. And one of the startling things that occurred was back in the beginning of 2000, they brought over Mayor Giuliano from New York to preach to us on a thing called the broken window theory. And what his theory was, that if there was an area that of depravity that had a broken window or a damaged bus shelter, to clean it up, smarten it up, you won't get your drug dealers, you won't get your shoplifters, you won't get your robberies, that all these crimes that are in the periphery around sort of poverty and everything else, and therefore your society gets better. Smarten these broken windows up. It was naive at the least. Where is this timeline taken back? The fact is, they're doing drugs because they're paying for heroin. They're on heroin because heroin is an analgesic. It's a painkiller. Pain can be mental, emotional, as well as physical. And the majority of them were there doing the drugs because they come from the care system. The care system that had appallingly let them down, and that they had been sexually abused, and they had no way of processing the damage that had been done to them. Our judicial system sets them up to fail. It follows them through from cradle to grave. These kids are known about, yet nothing happens. They grow up, they become bad in class, they become violent. They get reported to the social services, yet the problem is still not addressed. They then commit minor acts and end up before the juvenile courts. Again, nothing is done. They commit then heavier acts, robberies or whatever, and end up before the magistrates' courts, yet nothing is done. They end up before the Crown Courts, and ultimately they end up going before the coroner's courts. Yet throughout all this circle, nothing ever breaks it. The people that are paid a good living wage to stop this are failing it. And sometimes it's deliberate, sometimes it's apathy, sometimes it's ignorance. I've just come back from Rotherham, a small steel town in the northwest cluster of the UK. I met with a social worker who had exposed the child prostitution problem. She ran an outreach group, and the kids were coming to her, and then one would tell her, another tell, and she looked into it. It was organised prostitution. It's a small little town. 2,000 children were being pimped out. She got attacked. She got attacked from the police. Her husband nearly lost his job. It nearly brought her to this point of suicide. And this is what they do. It's orchestrated and it was manipulated at the highest echelons. She said it was coming from the high-ranking officers, and it was. But yet all they would offer up would be the lower-ranking officers for some form of malfeasance, whatever. But it is being orchestrated at the very top. My investigation showed a strong link with high-ranked officers and organised criminals. I spoke with another child abuse investigator, a quite high-ranked officer, and I spoke to him from Manchester. Again, he had a proven link between high-ranked officers and organised criminals and child prostitution there. We had a glimmer of hope in the form of a chief constable, a commissioner of police for a county called Wiltshire. The man's name is Mike Veal. He stood up and he investigated child prostitution, child trafficking, child abuse, everything else, but involved former Prime Minister Ted Heath. he turned around in Parliament and he said, if they can attack me, because he came under attack, and he said he came under attack from places he didn't even know existed. And he said, if they can attack me, God knows what they'll do to John Wedger, which in a way was a bit of an accolade. But, and I spoke to him and he said, it's just vile, John. It is vile. I then looked at the policeman's biggest fear is going to prison. And they know it. They know it. This is deliberate. What we're looking at is deliberate. When you're a policeman, you take an oath, and your oath is, I will act without fear or without favour. Someone said to me, John, don't judge others for the lack of bravery and commitment you've shown. I do not see myself as brave. I see myself as a man who believes in protecting the vulnerable, doing God's work, and doing what my oath said, to act without fear or without favour. They are going against their oath. And I said, we will look at this word fear, shall we? What are they frightened of? Telling the truth. Where the real fear lies is this young child laying in a kid's home at night, and they're coming and they're taking the blankets from over him. That's the real fear. We need to get a grip. You come under attack, and you do come under attack, and it's painful when it hurts, and it does do its best to destroy you. Maggie Oliver said to me, John, I was going to prison. The CPS turned round and said, we've got enough evidence. If you don't come to some agreement, admit to whatever, then you're found guilty, you will go to prison. She had to tell her children she was going to prison. The CPS in the end with me turned around and said, John Wedger's mitigation was so powerful, we could never convict him. I said to them, I submitted my statement prior to any trial. I wrote a statement and I gave it to Chris Dick and said, here's my statement. Whatever you say I've done, I don't care. But I will not be tried by you, I will be tried in a Crown Court. And I will be tried by my peers and I will be tried fairly. I've done nothing wrong, and I listed every single person from the bottom right the way up to the top who was involved, who knew about it, who did nothing, who then did nothing, who did nothing. This went right up to Bernard Hogan Howe and now to Chris Dick. Bernard Hogan Howe knew about this. The campaign of bullying on me orchestrated under his command. He has now been appointed by the House of Lords to look into child grooming gangs and how they existed. Well, I might save him the trouble. I can do that for him. It is wrong there. Looking now, I was asked to make an address to Lord Pearson's office regarding the presence of grooming gangs and how it works, the mechanics of it all. They're looking at it from a very sort of religious background, that it's Muslim gangs. This is a bigger picture. This is a bigger picture. Kids are a commodity. And one of the things I want to refer back to is Mark Dutroux. Whenever I give a talk, you have to make things relevant. We don't look at the third world and how they're dealing with things, because there are different people. Let's look at what we got on our backyard. One of the countries that's demographically very similar to us is Belgium. In living memory, it went on in Belgium. And it went on with Mark Dutroux. And the kids that came forward were so pigeonholed in what they could talk about. Anything that went outside of Mark Dutroux, they weren't allowed. I think it was 23 to 25 civilian witnesses died in the lead up to the trial.
90.
Absolutely unbelievable, yep. And then the people took the power back. They blew the windows out with the fire engines of the parliamentary office. And then they sprayed horse manure all over the building, and they took to the streets, didn't they? Half a million people. And what do? We only kick off when someone throws a cat in a wheelie bin. If we allow our children to be attacked and preyed on in this way, we have failed as a decent and moral society. And we are doing that, and we are doing nothing. It has to stop. And I don't want no glory, but people like myself, we need backing.
That's former DC John Wedger there speaking to the International Tribunal for Natural Justice. That's the ITNJ.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, we look now at one powerful arm of the Israel lobby, which began around the same time as the Zionist Project back in the late 1800s, the B'nai B'rith.
B'nai B'rith, the words mean sons of the covenant. It's Hebrew words. The B'nai B'rith was set up allegedly in 1843 in New York City by approximately 12 obscure Freemasons. The B'nai B'rith was quickly centered, actually, in Cincinnati in the 1850s. And its virtual sole preoccupation was a very small organization. By the time of the Civil War, it had about between 1,000 and 1,500 members in America. Its preoccupation was to build up the party that was trying to break up the United States. They ran various southern and northern, which were called Copperhead, political operations. And we've written a lot about this. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail on that. But these people, even though most of the Jewish people in America were living in the north, especially after immigrants came in from Germany, and most of the Jewish people in the Civil War were pro-Union, the B'nai B'rith was entirely pro-Confederate. And many of its leaders were arrested by the United States as Confederate spies during the American Civil War, including the head of the B'nai B'rith operation in Washington, D.C., Simon Wolfe. He was arrested almost immediately upon coming to Washington by Lincoln, by the head of Lincoln's Secret Service. Later on, he was a close friend of John Wilkes Booth, and the day that Lincoln was assassinated, he went drinking with John Wilkes Booth, and they supposedly talked about John Wilkes Booth's personal problems, and a few hours later, Wilkes Booth killed Lincoln. This is a part of the British party in Freemasonry, the British faction in politics, and they're allied to other British operations. So you can't understand this without, again, going back to this question of Great Britain. Remember that we had a revolution against England. And then a generation later, that was in 1776. In 1812, we had another war against England, the Second War of Independence. They wanted to take the country back. We beat them in that war. Then there was a civil war later on, 1861. And the British supplied guns to the South. They wanted to break up the United States. They didn't want to have any free countries anywhere. They didn't want to have any strong nations anywhere. So they whipped up the Southerners to fight against the United States. They lost that. They didn't give up. In fact, they had more and more power as an empire. And they have these factions. Now, I was talking earlier about their faction among the Jews. The Jewish religion is a survival from ancient times. There's various complications to it, but it's essentially identified with the Old Testament. Well, these people are not religious. The B'nai B'rith is a social organization, a political organization, and the basis of the B'nai B'rith is a political manipulation of race. They have a committee called the Anti-Defamation League. That's a committee of this B'nai B'rith. In the 20th century, when this Anti-Defamation League has existed, they have specialized in saying in public that certain people were anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic. And they're very selective about this because they didn't participate during the time that Hitler was the dictator of Germany. They didn't participate in the movement against Hitler. They also participated in the Ku Klux Klan. They also blackmailed J. Edgar Hoover, who had certain sexual problems and certain personal problems. J. Edgar Hoover. And you will find that the gangsters who make up, I'll give you an example of one of these guys, Moe Dalit. Morris Dalit, D-A-L-I-T-Z, got the award from the B'nai B'rith, from the Anti-Defamation League. They call it the Torch of Liberty Award because he gave them a lot of money. But also because he's an owner of Hollywood Productions. He is he's the main corporate owner for Meyer Lansky in Las Vegas. He is one of the five or six chiefs of organized crime in America. There are other people like Kenneth Bialk and others. Organized crime of the Meyer Lansky faction, that is Jewish organized crime, is represented in the political world by this Anti-Defamation League. Now, what is their religion? See, this is where you get down to the brass tacks of the thing. In New York City, they had a chancellor of schools recently driven out of office by the voters and the parents because he was promoting something called the Rainbow Curriculum. Good liberal mishmash, right? Well, this Rainbow Curriculum promoted the idea that children should be taught to be comfortable with homosexuals, with adult homosexuals. And the parents thought this was not a good idea. A lot of the people promoting that were members of the North American Man-Boy Love Association, who were pederasts. The Anti-Defamation League fought for that curriculum, helped to produce that curriculum, and fought against the people who didn't like it, including Jews, Christians, and others in New York City. Now, what's the religious basis for them doing that? Well, you have to understand what they represent. In the real world, they represent what I've been talking about tonight. These are thugs representing this traditional party of criminal activities associated with the British Empire. You've had this throughout time immemorial. You've had people who are associated with crime and who would say that they have something to do with religion, but they represent something different than that. You cannot understand these things without studying their history. And you have to ask certain theological and other questions about them, certainly. But you have to see what they do in the real world. And they are the party of organized crime in the United States.
That's Anton Chaykin there talking about the B'nai B'rith. And we're going to finish this evening by having a listen to a chap called Gilad Atzmon. He's a musician, jazz musician. He's actually, I spoke to him earlier this week from the United States. And what he's doing is he's bringing, I suppose, this whole business of anti-Semitism and accusations of such bang up to date by looking at the his take on the attacks on Ken Livingstone.
We are dealing with a catastrophic, vicious circle. The actions taken by Israel clearly lead to anti-Jewish feelings. So when people see Israel deploying snipers and drones and airplanes against unarmed civilians, protesters, killing them and injuring them on thousands, people are very upset. And since Israel defines itself as the Jewish state, some people are very upset with the Jews. Such developments make, or can make, Jews very insecure. What do? They consider making aliyah, immigrating to Israel. And this is the cycle. The more brutal Israel is, the more Jews seek shelter in Israel, which is exactly the fundamental demand of the Zionist agenda, to make Israel into the home of the Jews. Now, the outcome is pretty devastating because, as we know, a lot of French Jews and British Jews and diaspora Jews in general have secured themselves a Holocaust shelter in Israel, in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem. These houses are basically standing there vacant, and Jewish Israelis cannot really find a roof in their own land. So they serve in the army, they commit all those atrocious crimes against humanity in the name of a vague concept, securing a home for diaspora Jews who don't even think practically of moving to Israel. They just keep it as a safe haven. And Israel definitely contribute to the rise of anti-Semitism. The devastating outcome is that Israel, bizarrely enough, benefits from such a rise.
going back to 1933 and looking at what was going on in Nazi Germany, it did seem that some sort of deal was being done between the Zionists and the Nazis in order to get rid of the Jews in Nazi Germany and send them over to Palestine, if that was possible.
Yeah.
So what would you make of Ken Livingstone's comment that Hitler supported Zionism? Do you think that's justified?
Ken Livingstone was telling the absolute truth. There was an Avara agreement, or in English, transfer agreement, that was signed in 1933 between the National Socialist regime in Germany and the Zionist institutions that were operating in Palestine. There was no Israel yet. Thanks to this agreement, more than 60,000 Jews from Germany and Austria managed to make Aliyah or immigrate to Palestine, and by doing so, probably saved their life. So there were some inaccurate details in Livingstone's statement. For instance, he spoke about Israel, and it was actually Palestine at the time. But his statement is 100% right. Now, the fact that such a hero, a political hero, an anti-racist, brings disrepute on a party in Britain by telling the truth means that Britain has removed itself from the liberal, enlightened ethos. It's not a free country anymore. It's a tyranny of correctness that is defined by Jewish sensitivities. But there is a further question. Why are Jews allegedly offended by someone looking into their past, or even more precisely, telling the truth about their past? What is it about the Avara agreement, the transfer agreement, that is so painful for Jews to admit? This is the question that we have to ask. And if the Jews cannot admit to themselves that there was such an agreement, why can Livingstone or the Labour Party have to pay the price? I argue the Jewish power is the power to silence criticism of Jewish power. Ken Livingstone was critical of something that can be realized as Jewish politics in the early 30s. What do we do with him? Jewish power. We silence him. The same power is employed against the Labour Party. It is very clear that some Zionist bodies really don't like Jeremy Corbyn. A fundamental advantage of a free society is the ability to call a spade a spade. Now, I'm doing it. I'm doing it, but I can definitely see that less and less people can afford to do it, because calling a spade, talking, for instance, about a clear historical fact that is approved by every Jewish history text, there was a Avara agreement. More than 60,000 Jews, German Jews, Austrian Jews, were saved by this Avara agreement. The fact that we cannot really address these issues in Britain suggests to us that Britain nowadays is not the Britain you were raised in or the Britain I immigrated to. It changed into a very problematic state. While politicians are operating within a given recognized language game, we artists are there to bring along a new language game. We artists are there to reshape the future and ideally present a prospect of a better future that entails peace, harmony, reconciliation, and so on and so on. But it goes farther. When it comes to music, when it comes to art, you just cannot lie. I cannot write a bad tune and convince you or force you to like it. I have to write a piece of melody that genuinely makes you cry or jolly or optimistic. This is the biggest power of aesthetics. This is the biggest power of music, especially music, because we are really dealing with an abstract language. This proximity to truthfulness makes musicians at large into people who can deliver the truth about Palestine. Now, let's make sure that everybody knows supporting Palestine can cost you your career. The music business worldwide is at large dominated by Jewish businessmen. Not only, but they are definitely by far overrepresented, especially in America. They are very forceful and they are mounting huge pressures on artists that express their views. I think that even Roger Waters, despite his strengths, could feel it in the last year when they tried to pull out some of his concerts, and we are talking about arenas. I've seen some concerts of mine being cancelled in the past. It didn't happen for a while now, but we are dealing with a very powerful lobby. They managed to expel thousands of people from 1,000 labor members. We can imagine that they succeed in pulling one jazz gig a year or there. Roger Waters is very dedicated to this cause because he was there. He was in Palestine and it touched his heart. I'm not an activist. I'm doing it because I'm fascinated by issues to do with Jewishness, ideologically, culturally. I can see how dominant Jewish culture is. In my recent book, Being in Time, I speak about the dominance of Jerusalem over Athens and the way I differentiate between the two. Athens is the birthplace of philosophy, of truthfulness. Jerusalem is the birthplace of obedience, litigation, rules, correctness. We are living in a Jerusalemite tyranny of correctness. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, what is it about Jerusalem that is so dominant, that its survival ability is seemingly stronger than Athens? And how do we bring Athens back? And I think that in terms of bringing Athens back, Roger Waters is a great force. He's not the only one. I see myself as a dedicated advocate of Athenian thinking. And I do want to believe that the Brits will find their way back.
What Gilad is saying there, Martin, is that there's an immense, powerful Israel lobby there. That's Gilad Atzmon. But he says there Britain is not a free country anymore, and things can happen to Ken Livingstone like they have.
Well, I mean, I think Ken Livingstone would probably agree. And don't forget, he was kicked out of the Labour Party before, and he kicked his way back in, and the GLC was abolished to get rid of him.
There is a meeting, isn't there, on Monday?
He's always been a thorn in my side.
Meeting on Monday, Corbyn, Anti-Semitism and Justice for Palestine. It's on Monday at 7 p.m. at the Arc Bar, which is 27 Broad Street. All sorts of people speaking there, which include the National Union of Teachers and Salma Yaqub.
Yeah, and there's also a spokesperson there from the Jewish Voice for Labour. So, you know, the idea that we're anti-Semites is rubbish.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 6. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.